Welcome to the McFarland's Public Policy in Practice podcast. This is our latest episode titled Carbon Taxes and Carbon Trading. Where are we now and where are we going? I am Rachel Richardson, Head of Banking and Finance Policy in the finance team at McFarland's, and I'm joined by David Gawke, Head of Public Policy at McFarland's, and Christine Long, Senior Counsel in our Derivatives and Trading Group. So, as I see it, we're in a position now where the science around climate change is no longer in dispute. We've just had COP26 in November last year, and the momentum's really picking up. As we noted in a previous podcast, some were disappointed that the Glasgow COP didn't go far enough, in that a global agreement on a carbon tax with a related carbon border adjustment mechanism wasn't debated. And others also view that the scaling of the voluntary carbon markets could be one of the key levers we have to use finance to slow the rise in global temperatures. So, moving quickly into the debate and provide some clarity, I'll turn to you first, David. So what actually is a carbon tax or a carbon price?
Well, let's start off with a sort of carbon price. The thinking behind this is that when we consume carbon, we pay the cost of whatever the good or product is, but we're not paying the full cost. We're not paying the environmental cost, the contribution towards climate change. And the thinking here is we need to incorporate that, what the economists call a sort of negative externality. We need to incorporate that into the price of the good or product. And so carbon pricing is an attempt to include the price of that negative externality into the price of the carbon. And now this could be in the form of a tax. So we could have a tax on particular products that use carbon or so on. There are other ways in which one can price carbon, which we'll talk about more, emission trading schemes particularly. But you end up in theory with the same effect that you have now priced in the carbon into the individual good or product.
Thank you, David. And to provide a bit more clarity, how do carbon taxes or carbon pricing, whichever, how do they actually help to lower emissions in practice? And why do people think they're important?
So economists tend to be very keen on carbon pricing because they will make the point that people respond to incentives. And by incorporating the cost of climate change into carbon, you are changing the incentives on people. So for consumers, we're now disincentivized to use carbon-intensive products, for example. And also for investors, because you've now sort of shifted the relative prices, they are incentivized into investing in low carbon technologies, alternatives to high carbon intensive products, etc. So you have done it that way. And the IMF, for example, the International Monetary Fund, has said that carbon pricing is the most powerful and efficient lever because it allows firms and households to find the lowest cost ways of reducing energy use and shifting towards cleaner alternatives. So to some extent, it's about using market mechanisms rather than, if you like, imprecise and sometimes heavy-handed regulation that might not be as precise. It puts powers, if you like, in the hands of individuals, consumers. They make choices, but they make choices reflecting the true price of carbon, not the price that we would pay without some kind of intervention.
So sort of channeling finance in the right direction.
Exactly. And one of the advantages of it as a policy instrument is that you can start off with a relatively low carbon price. But if you've got credibility that you're going to put that carbon price up, investors who are obviously thinking about returns in the future are going to say, well, look, you know, these prices are going to go up. There is therefore a bigger gap in the market for technologies that lower our carbon emissions that will have a price advantage. So let's invest now. So before the pain of carbon pricing hits consumers, you can start to incentivize investment in alternatives to high carbon activities.
Really interesting. With my finance lawyer hat on, I would describe that as well as lowering the cost of capital for those businesses that are sort of doing good in that area.
Yeah. It's the relative cost that really matters here, and it absolutely is lowering the relative cost here.
Okay, and moving on to an acronym. We love acronyms in the ESG and sustainable finance world. What is a CBAM, David?
Okay, well, a CBAM is a carbon border adjustment mechanism, and this seeks to address one of the problems that if you as a country says, right, we're going to put a price on carbon, so things that are produced here, we're going to put a carbon tax on them, or we're going to price it through an emissions trading scheme or whatever it might be, is you then have carbon leakage because you're putting up the prices of the goods that you produce in this country, but you can get cheap imports from those countries that haven't adopted carbon pricing. So what a carbon border adjustment mechanism does is essentially say, right, if you if something is imported from a jurisdiction with a lower carbon price, we will make up the difference and impose that as a tax, if you like, a tariff, and that deals with the issue. Now, there are plenty of challenges with this, all issues in terms of WTO rules and what have you. But the thinking behind it is that then incentivizes those other jurisdictions to also put a carbon price on. And you know, we've gone through the COP process. We can see how difficult it can be to reach international agreement. The tendency is to sort of let others bear the burden, not put costs upon your own economy. The advantage that exponents of a carbon border adjustment mechanism will say, a CBAM will say, this puts pressure on other countries to put up their carbon price, because otherwise the revenue will go to the other country that is imposing the CBAM. So that's the thinking about it. It's a way in which countries can, without complete unanimity across the world, can it put pressure on other countries to also raise the price of carbon.
That's interesting, David. And just sticking with you for the moment and looking at a sort of practical example, the EU, I think, is set to impose a CBAM to apply in 2026. We don't have an internationally agreed global CBAM. How will that actually operate in practice without any international agreement?
Well, again, what you can do and what the EU will do is look to impose it at the border. So if you're bringing in goods that have been made elsewhere that doesn't have a carbon price, there'll be a way of potentially quite rough and ready way of calculating what the carbon price will be. And if you want to import it, you will have to pay that tariff. Now, those costs will ultimately be passed on to consumers, by the way. But nonetheless, it puts incentives in place in that direction. And at the moment, the EU, perhaps more advanced than anywhere else, but there's clearly interest in the US and indeed the UK. We'll talk about ETSs in a moment or so. But that's what they're looking to do, and to have something in place for 2026.
Great. Thanks, David. And just moving over to Christine for the moment. David mentioned an ETS. And I think lots of people, particularly in the UK, don't realise that we actually have an emissions trading scheme in the UK. In brief, how does that scheme work?
Right. Well, an ETS stands for Emissions Trading Scheme. It's basically going back to what David was saying about incentives. So it's called a cap and trade scheme, which has got two elements. So the first one is the cap, which is the limit on the amount of carbon that can be emitted by compliance entities, so those people that the scheme applies to. And then the second element is the trade, which creates allowances for units of carbon that people who are covered by the scheme are allowed to emit. And so those allowances are equal to the cap, and so they can be traded on a market. And companies that are covered by the scheme have to buy enough allowances in order to cover all of their emissions. So their emissions get monitored, and at the end of the year, they get compared with the number of allowances that have been purchased. If you haven't purchased enough allowances to cover your emissions, then you've got to either pay a fine. But the idea is that the fine is sufficiently punitive that you really want to avoid it if you possibly can. What happens then is the supply of emission allowances is slowly reduced over time. So that does two things. First of all, total emissions have to go down, or total permitted emissions have to go down, because the number of allowances are going down and you're only allowed to emit in tandem with the number of allowances that there are. And then obviously as supply decreases, demand will increase and the price will go up. And then you've got a financial incentive to actually decide that instead of buying all these allowances, you're actually going to, you know, have a decarbonisation plan. And ultimately, reducing your emissions will be cheaper than buying allowances that allow you to carry on emitting.
That's really interesting. And back to you, David, if I may. What is the difference between a carbon tax and a carbon pricing scheme?
Yeah, no, good question. And of course, in theory, both of them have the same effect. They put a price on carbon, and that has the impact that I've talked about. In practice, they work in different ways. Carbon taxes, as the name suggests, is a direct tax levied on a given value against a quantity of emissions, if you like. You could say we have got a number of those carbon taxes. They're not particularly coherent and they don't necessarily reflect the carbon that is used, but we've got things like fuel duty and air passenger duty, the climate change levy, many others. But there's no one coherent price put on carbon. Whereas a carbon pricing scheme is, Chrissy sort of explained the mechanism there in terms of you have a cap and then there's a bidding process for it and that puts up the price. I tend to think that from a politician's point of view, there are certain advantages with emissions trading schemes because it looks less obviously like the government imposing the cost. So businesses compete for it and they get their quota and they bid for that and that price gets passed on. Mm-hmm. But it's less visible to the end consumer, whereas a carbon tax, it's kind of much more obvious that the government has imposed it. So if I may be slightly cynical about politicians...
I think you're allowed.
I'm allowed now to be cynical about politicians. I think that's why they tend to favour carbon taxes. I think the problem with carbon emissions and the criticism that you get of emission trading schemes is, one, they tend to be focused on particular sectors. And if you want efficiency, you want something that works across sectors, so they can be a bit bitty. And the second point is that perhaps they are more vulnerable to lobbying. And so, the history of the EU ETS is trying to get the sort of price right. You grandfather existing producers, which is all very well for them, but gives them a competitive advantage over new entrants. So there's a bit of a concern about it. I mean, in theory, what you get with a tax is that you get certainty in terms of for businesses and consumers as to the price of the carbon. But what you get in terms of certainty from an ETS is the level of emissions. Now, of course, you can play around with the parameters, and what seems to be happening at the moment with the EU ETS is that they are varying the cap in order to hit a particular price. So maybe the difference between the two on that basis is perhaps less than it first appears. But there are differences behind it. We both, most places will do a mix of carbon taxes and ETS. Mm-hmm. I think probably most economists would argue, not all, but most would favour carbon taxes.
And moving on to differences, Christine, what are the differences between the EU's ETS, or Emissions Trading Scheme, and the UK's version of that?
Well, actually, they're incredibly similar because the UK was part of the decision making when the EU scheme was created and the UK was still part of the EU. Following Brexit, the EU scheme was onshored into the UK, and the UK is now going its own way and deciding how it wants its own scheme to be. And so the sectors regulated are the same as the EU ETS. The greenhouse gas emissions that are regulated are both the same. But the two key differences are that the UK has set a lower cap than the current EU cap, which in turn has resulted in a much higher price for UK emission allowances. And then the other big difference is the UK has not allowed carbon offsets to be used as emission allowances. And carbon offsets are allowed to be used, or certain types of carbon offset are allowed to be used under the EU scheme.
Do you think that that might be a bit of an advantage, either of you, for the UK coming up with their scheme after the EU scheme? Is that a benefit of Brexit, do you think?
I'm not sure that it necessarily is. And look, there are some potential tensions here if we diverge. Because, I mean, what happens, for example, with Northern Ireland? No one has quite worked that out with the Northern Ireland Protocol. If there are different ETSs operating in different places, you know, what is going to happen there? And can that be a sort of barrier to trade? So that's another row for down the line on that. I mean, in the end, what you probably want is international convergence.
Mm-hmm.
So there might be some short-term advantages, I guess, if you go second, that you can design it in a different way. But if we're all trying to move to a place where there is one international price for carbon, then you know, the fewer divergences as you can have as the better, and that's not just looking at kind of EU UK, that's looking across the world, and that's the argument coming back to CBAMs. You know, one of the points about CBAMs is it incentivizes everybody to go down the same track, and so there's a lot of discussion about a coalition of the willing of the EU, the UK, and the US,
mm-hmm.
all moving in a particular direction. And then others will follow, given how important those consumer markets are for the world economy.
Mm. And Christine, I've heard about the voluntary carbon markets. You hear about them relatively frequently. And you also hear about the compliance markets.
Mm.
How do they differ?
Mm. So compliance markets are basically what we've just been talking about. So they are markets created by financial regulation, where if you're covered by that piece of regulation, you have to comply, you have to trade in the market. So someone covered by the an ETS would be forced to trade carbon allowances. Voluntary markets, on the other hand, are voluntary. So you have people, so either individuals or companies or governments, choosing to buy carbon credits, and they then use those carbon credits in some way as part of their own decarbonisation or net zero strategy. The other key difference is that under an ETS, you would talk about an emission allowance. So that's an allowance to emit carbon. In the voluntary markets, on the other hand, generally you talk about carbon credits, although the term carbon credits is also used to refer to EU allowances, but we won't talk about that. Carbon credits, in my mind, is something that has removed carbon from the atmosphere, or it has sequestered it, or it's carbon that has been avoided that would have otherwise been emitted. So it's a credit in the best sense of the word. It's something that has removed carbon from the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Christine. And why do we actually need the voluntary carbon markets if they're voluntary? And why are people so sceptical about them?
So, okay, so there's a lot to talk about.
Yeah, sorry.
That's okay. So basically, the carbon markets, the voluntary carbon markets, have potential to do a lot of good. So if they work at their best, they will be a source of finance that will enable projects which lower emissions and help the planet to happen where they wouldn't otherwise have happened. That's the ideal aim for the voluntary carbon markets. And even more ideally, in doing so, this will deliver benefits to local communities that wouldn't otherwise have happened. So voluntary carbon markets are basically a source of funding for decarbonising. However, there are a number of concerns, and if carbon markets are going to be scaled as people want them to be scaled, those concerns really need to be addressed before that happens. So the first key concern is around a concept called additionality. And this goes to the concept that the projects generating the carbon credits, they need to have not happened anyway. They need to be additional to what the host country was going to do anyway as part of its transition to net zero. The reason why this is important is that if the project generating the carbon credit isn't additional, then there's a strong likelihood that you're going to have a double claim on that carbon credit.
Mm-hmm. So double counting, really?
Yes, exactly. It's called double counting. I think of it as double claiming because you basically have a claim made by the buyer of the carbon credit. Mm-hmm. So the buyer may have emitted one ton of carbon and it may purchase a credit which has removed one ton of carbon. And the buyer will then want to make a claim on that credit to say, well, I'm at net zero now because my ton that I emitted has been cancelled out by the credit that I purchased. The problem is that if the host country where the emission reduction happened has got something called an NDC, which is under Article 6, countries will commit to reducing their emissions. And so if that country has made a commitment under its NDC, it will then compare its actual, the emission reductions that are happening in its national inventory. And the project that generated that carbon credit, the emission reduction generated from that project will be counted in its inventory. And so if it then looks at its NDC and says, well, I need to reduce by X amount. And look, there's been this emission from this project that's reduced by X amount. I'll put that towards my NDC. Then that's a double claim because you've got the host country mm-hmm. putting the emission reduction towards its NDC. And you've got the buyer of the carbon credit putting it, offsetting it against the ton of carbon that it's emitted.
And I suppose, as it's expected that countries will amend their nationally defined contributions over time, that could be a real concern actually going forwards.
Yes, exactly. And that's where corresponding adjustments and Article 6 of the Paris Agreement come in. So under Article 6, there is a mechanism that's been created for countries to trade carbon credits with each other. And one of the key breakthroughs at COP26, which we were mentioning earlier, is that there are now rules which set out when countries have to make corresponding adjustments. So a corresponding adjustment, if you go back to the example of the national emissions inventory, being compared with the NDC. If you've got a country where a project has happened which has reduced emissions and they've shown up in the national emissions inventory, what the country has to do is adjust its inventory to pretend that the emission reduction didn't happen. And that's called a corresponding adjustment. And what that means is that any project that has generated the emission reduction and the host country has made a corresponding adjustment in relation to that project, you can then buy those carbon credits knowing that they will not be used to be counted towards the NDC and they are therefore like a stamp of additionality. Mm-hmm. And so you know that they're not going to be double claimed by the host country. And one of the kind of thorny questions in relation to voluntary carbon markets is whether host countries should be required to make corresponding adjustments in respect of projects funded by the voluntary carbon markets. And there are no rules about that at the moment. There are rules setting out how, when corresponding adjustments have to be made in the Article 6 markets. So the Article 6 markets are the markets where countries trade with each other, whereas voluntary carbon markets are where, you've got countries with trading with individuals or companies.
And what about the actual quality of the credits themselves?
Yeah, so not all credits are made equal. Generally, you've got two types of credits. You've got credits that remove carbon, so removal credits, which take carbon out of the atmosphere, or they sequester it. So they take it out and they capture it and store it, either via natural means or artificial means. And then you've got reduction credits, which basically the person buying the credit is paying for someone else's decarbonisation plan. And that can be a very efficient way of allocating the right money at the right time to the right decarbonisation project. So if you've got someone who wants to decarbonise, but actually it's incredibly expensive and it's going to take, you know, decades in order to do so. And you've got another corporation which also needs to decarbonize, but it can't afford to do so, but it's relatively easy and you can make some quick wins quite quickly, then the first person can basically pay for the project of the second person, and that will enable that decarbonisation plan to happen much quicker than it would have done otherwise. So that's a reduction credit, and that's to be contrasted with a removal credit. The problem comes when you start then looking at the carbon credits that were issued under the Clean Development Mechanism under the Kyoto Protocol, because when that was started, there was basically everything to play for, because no countries had NDCs, no countries or corporations really had decarbonisation plans, and so any credit generated was better than nothing. And so there's actually a huge variety of types of carbon credits and projects that have been authorised under the Clean Development Mechanism, which are in circulation at the moment. But in the context now of the Paris Agreement architecture and NDCs, they aren't really high enough quality, and almost certainly no longer additional. And that means that they can't be used in the same way that they could be used before Paris. And so there's a problem with what to do about these legacy carbon credits.
And what about greenwashing? Is there a risk of greenwashing with the carbon credits?
Yes, there is a risk of greenwashing. This goes to the problem about creating transparency, because there are so many areas where you need maximum transparency in relation to the project that has generated the carbon credit, how the carbon credit's been certified, to basically make sure that you know exactly what the credit that you have purchased, you know, to make sure it does what it says on the tin, which will then enable you to make a claim on that carbon credit, which is actually valid. And there are various points at which that could go wrong. And if that does go wrong at any point, then you are at risk of potentially greenwashing if you make a bold claim about what that carbon credit does. So, for example, if you offset a carbon credit that you think has removed a ton of carbon from the atmosphere, but actually it hasn't. It's not a removal credit. It's a reduction credit. You know, the question arises, can you validly offset that against carbon that you've emitted and claim to be net zero?
So if you're making a statement in the market, you've got to be able to have the data and supporting materials to back it up.
Exactly. And there are no rules around this, mm-hmm. I should say, at the moment. There are standards coming out through various bodies, but there's nothing to actually penalise someone who makes a claim about how they've used a carbon credit, which happens not to be true.
Yeah, interesting. We've talked about lots of issues. Have you got any suggestions, or are there any ways to deal with these issues?
So I think, as I say, there are standards that are coming out, and there are principles that have been published already, and there's a lot that's been written about, you know, the proper use for carbon credits as part of an offsetting strategy. I think the key principle is, for buyers, offsetting should be seen as a measure of last resort, i.e., if you can decarbonize, then you should, and you should not buy carbon credits as an alternative to decarbonizing. However, it's recognized that there's only so much you can decarbonize, and there will be some residual emissions. And it's for those emissions that you can then use offsetting in order to mop up those emissions. I think the second key principle is around transparency. If you're a buyer, you know, doing your due diligence as much as you possibly can, and knowing, you know, what you're buying, and also the impact that it's had on the surrounding community as well. And then obviously, if you're, you know, a project generator, it's thinking about all of those things. It's thinking about what you say about the project and what it does. Again, the impact on the local communities. So I think transparency is the key thing that's going to help.
Back to you, David. There are some people that would criticise the concept of carbon pricing and the carbon markets. For example, people point to the rising living costs that we're going through at the moment with a carbon tax. And others claim that the carbon markets are giving a company or a country a licence to pollute. What are your thoughts on some of that?
Well, on the point of a licence to pollute, I think I'd argue that pragmatically, we are not going to go to zero carbon overnight. The question is, what is the best way of getting there? What is the way in which we can do this at the lowest cost? And using market mechanisms, it's not the whole answer, but it surely has to be part of what we need to do to get to net zero. On the point about the cost, and that is the real big political challenge, although I was struck by something that Tim Harford from the Financial Times, more or less on Radio 4, set out and said, look, if you look at our carbon emissions per person, we produce around about the equivalent of 6 tonnes per person, plus another two or three tons to reflect the carbon footprint of imported goods. And if you impose on that £100 per tonne tax, which is quite a bit more than the IMF recommend, you end up with something that costs just over £2 a day. Now, we shouldn't scoff at that. For a lot of people, you know, something of that size of £700-£800 or so is a lot, and that is going to be quite painful. Very painful, but for others it isn't. It's not an extraordinary sum of money, and of course, money that you raise through carbon taxes or through selling off permits under an ETS can be recycled, can be used to protect the most vulnerable. So one would think there would be policy ways in which you can address that. But it does have to be said, there isn't a political party in this country that is advocating an all-inclusive carbon tax. That isn't where the debate is. The debate, you know, politically at the moment is all about, well, here are the opportunities, here are the new green jobs. Nobody is really going out there saying this is going to have a cost, but it's a cost that we have to pay. And as a consequence, there are some questions about whether this is ever politically deliverable. But advocates of a carbon tax will say, if you're not going to win that argument, then you're never going to get to net zero, because in the end, if the public won't consent to policies in this area, they won't consent, they'll oppose it, and they'll never get delivered. And if we are going to deliver this, then we should be delivering it in the most efficient, least costly way possible. Advocates for it will say this means putting a price on carbon.
And we wait to see how that develops. I just want to thank David and Christine very much for joining us on this episode of Policy in Practice. Thank you very much for listening.